I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. The idea of busing to desegregate schools dates back to the 1970s, but the term has almost become a bad word since. Last month, two Democratic presidential candidates battled over the issue, and it got us wondering, how successful were efforts to desegregate schools back then, and what was Kansas City's history with busing? Today, busing and why the practice hasn't fallen completely out of favor. Then, the Cinemark on the Plaza closed in May, and the loss left some teens in the area looking for a new spot to hang out. We'll ask where Kansas City youths can keep entertained this summer without too many restrictions, all while staying out of trouble. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. When California Senator Kamala Harris confronted Joe Biden at the second Democratic presidential debate, the issue was busing. Biden, Harris said, had worked with segregationist senators back in the early 70s to oppose busing. The charge suggested that school desegregation efforts will be an issue in the 2020 presidential race. So we wondered, what's the context for Harris's remarks? How successful or unsuccessful were 1970s-era busing efforts across the country? And what was Kansas City's history with busing? And could busing be a remedy in the future to help desegregate the Kansas City School District? With us, Dr. Erica Frankenberg is a professor of education at Penn State University. She joins us from the studios of WPSU on the Penn State campus. Dr. Frankenberg, thanks for taking some time.
Thanks for inviting me to join you.
Lynn Horsley's here. She's a former reporter for the Kansas City Star, where she covered Kansas City schools for a number of years. Lynn, nice to see you again.
Great to be here.
Professor, with big city school districts like the one in Kansas City showing few signs of integration even today, has Senator Harris just opened up an issue that's received little attention in recent presidential elections and that school desegregation here?
Right. I was certainly not expecting to hear school desegregation come up as I was only half-heartedly paying attention to the debate, to be honest. And so it's been exciting to have this rejoin the forefront of the discussion. I will say, though it wasn't part of President Obama's campaigns, in the last couple of years he was in office, he had a very strong Secretary of Education, John King, who spoke very eloquently about the importance of school desegregation in his life and why there were educational and social benefits for integration. Mm-hmm. And he tried to do a lot in with his discretionary efforts to further school integration.
Right. You know, Lynn, we just had this election for mayor and city council here in Kansas City, just had an election for the school board in Kansas City. And this new report just came out from Kansas City schools that show the district is more segregated today, hard to believe, than it was back in the 1990s. So I'm wondering, was busing or school desegregation an issue in this recent round of elections here in town?
Well, it really wasn't, and that's partly because the school district is a separate agency. You know, the mayor has no control over the school district, and in fact, the mayors try to support the district, but they cannot dictate the policies. I will say that, you know, Kansas City's desegregation case did have a massive busing effort that made an attempt at integration. It was busing on steroids. They were busing 31,000 students in 1992.
Every day.
And it was an extraordinary effort. It was very expensive. It really did not succeed in integrating the schools to a great degree. It was a noble experiment, and it was very different from many of the other busing programs across the country.
But even though this new report has come out saying the schools are more segregated today, we're not hearing more conversations about busing right now.
No, I don't think so. Although there still is busing in the Kansas City School District.
But just to get the kids to school, not to desegregate the schools.
Not to desegregate.
Right?
The desegregation case ended in the late 90s. It was enormously expensive. I think people didn't feel that it worked very successfully. And I'm not hearing that integration and school busing for integration is on people's radar.
You know, Professor Frankenberg, there's no question here that the busing efforts of the 60s and 70s that included the busing of Kamala Harris in North Berkeley, California, were intensely controversial. Give us some context here. Why did that busing happen? What was the thinking back then?
Yeah, I think you raise a couple of really important points. First, I'd say that busing may have been controversial in some communities the first year or two after it was implemented, but in many communities, the experience after the TV cameras had gone became much more positive. And so, for example, a Louisville, Kentucky, which had had people resisting in the 1970s widespread busing across the countywide district, in fact, voluntarily has continued to do that for almost 20 years now. But when we talk about busing, as you were talking about a minute ago, I think it's really important to point out what busing is. It has been sort of a flashpoint, even coming out of the recent debate. But in fact, busing is a tool that is used both for desegregation efforts as well as for non-desegregation efforts as well. And prior to Brown, was used to maintain segregation. And so I think the better question for me is to think about how can we bring about desegregation, not do we want busing or not, because I think it's been politically construed as something that is very confusing to the average person.
I was going to say, and correct me if I'm wrong, Professor, that the perception of busing, it seems to have this negative connotation attached to it as something of a failed experiment. Is that accurate from your vantage point there?
I don't think it is, actually. You know, and so when we look about the effects of school desegregation, we see a wide-ranging set of benefits for students of all races, both African-American students who were the focus of most desegregation efforts, as well as for white students, Latinx students, et cetera. And so in terms of was it a failure or not, absolutely not. The research shows that school integration was quite successful. Then if you look at public opinion around this, I think what we sometimes think about is we see really contradictory responses. People want school desegregation, but they also want neighborhood schools. Mm-hmm. And when we have deeply segregated neighborhoods, and of course the Kansas City metropolitan area has a bunch of different school districts that layer over top of this residential segregation, it makes tools like busing required in order to achieve integrated schools.
Professor, how widespread was busing back in the 60s and 70s? I mean, how many cities were taking part?
So busing became a widespread tool sort of in the late 60s. There was a 1971 Supreme Court decision that out of Charlotte-Mecklenburg that said that busing was a tool that could be used to try to break the patterns of segregated schools that were still persisting, you know, almost two decades after the Brown decision. So we have no clear idea of exactly how many districts were doing it, but there's probably at least 1,000 districts that were under court order at one point in time for school desegregation, and a bunch of other districts that were required to negotiate voluntary agreements so that the federal government didn't cut off their funding under the 1964 Civil Rights Act. Again, given the fact that we have and had residential segregation, it's probably the case that districts were using school busing as one of the tools. However, they were also using school busing for a lot of other non-integration related matters. So the annoying answer is we don't really know.
Huh. Okay. Well, Lynn, what did Kansas City attempt to do, and what was the objective here in town?
Well, Kansas City's case was complicated, and partly that was because the judge, first of all, Kansas City's case came later. It was in the 80s. The judge eliminated the suburbs from having to participate in the program. So it was just within the district, and then they were trying to lure in suburban white students voluntarily. This was not forced busing, it was voluntary. They created a host of magnet schools. And
which
then,
are specialized schools in a way, right?
Right. And at one point, the lawyer for this district said, we're busing everybody everywhere. Kids in the same block could go to different magnet schools. So you didn't have a group of kids from one neighborhood being bused to a particular school. Even African-American leaders, I think, felt, again, this is Kansas City's case, which was very unusual and very complicated. Even Kansas City's African-American leaders, I think, came to feel that it diminished the neighborhood schools and therefore diminished the social fabric of the urban neighborhoods.
Huh. I've got some numbers here. The number of bus routes in Kansas City exploded from about 100 to something like 850. One report noted that at any given bus stop, it wasn't uncommon to find 10 kids there going to 10 different schools. I mean, that's just remarkable.
They were running 100,000 miles a day at a cost of $26 to $30 million a year. And now they do still bus kids, and I think it's at about $12 million a year, and it's maybe 10,000 kids. But again, it's not busing for desegregation. It's busing to get kids to schools. I think the Kansas City case was a desegregation experiment. It was voluntary, not forced busing, and it just wasn't terribly successful. The district, as we said, has fewer, a smaller percentage of white kids now than back then.
And 20, 30 years ago, even white kids from the suburbs weren't drawn to Kansas City schools, despite the fact so much money was spent to bring them up to way beyond par, and all these amenities, swimming pools and the chemistry labs, it didn't matter.
They had hoped to attract 10,000 suburban kids at the height of the program. They had attracted 1,500. It just wasn't sufficient. So now I think the bigger challenge for the Kansas City School District is competition from charter schools. Mm-hmm. You know, that's an issue that they are still wrestling with. I think, you know, the Kansas City case was designed to desegregate the schools, and ultimately parents decided we really want quality schools. That's what's most important to us. Mm-hmm. And the district's desegregation case tried to increase quality, but the district had all kinds of superintendent turnover. There was just constant turmoil. It was a massive effort, and there were pockets of excellence, no doubt about it, and there were some schools that were integrated and terrifically successful. But overall, system-wide, they did never achieve the success they were hoping for.
I was going to say, when did busing for desegregation purposes in Kansas City end, Lynn?
I think it ended in 1999. The Supreme Court ruled in 1995 that the district needed to stop trying to lure in white suburban kids, and it needed to return the district to local control. Mm. And that wound down over the next couple of years.
Professor Frankenberg, so that's the Kansas City experience. Where did busing prove to be a success? What cities would you point to?
Sure. I think there are a lot of examples to point to. I think Kamala Harris's district of Berkeley, California, is a district that still uses busing as part of its voluntary integration plan today. It's a little bit different than when Kamala was there, but is still very popular today.
Why did it work there? Do you have any sense? Maybe I don't want to bore down too deeply here in a city maybe you're not familiar with, but any sense of why it worked there?
Yeah, I have actually been studying it because I think it's a really interesting case of a district that has changed what it's been doing over the year, but is really committed to the fact that the children that are being educated, they're going to grow up and be adults in a global, diverse environment, and it wouldn't be doing their job as educators if they weren't preparing them in the most diverse schools possible. So they combine school choice alongside busing today. You know, I think Louisville, Kentucky is, again, another example. It's a countywide district that is voluntarily busing as part of its plan, but parents are able to choose the schools that they go to. It's a little different from what Kansas City was doing because there, the city and the suburbs are combined in a county. Ah. And so you have a different kind of atmosphere. So there are a lot of places that are, you know, I've identified about 60 districts that are voluntarily integrating today. They don't have to, but they think it's important to do so. And I think a big reason why is they see the benefits for their children.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR, and we're talking about this debate that California Senator Kamala Harris sparked at a recent Democratic presidential debate. The issue was busing, the history of busing, Joe Biden's role in it. We're talking about the Kansas City experience and what happened across the country. You know, Lynn, Professor Frankenberg, brings up a point, you know, Kansas City long plagued by state lines and county lines, and that made the experience here just by boundary lines very different than what she just described in Louisville, for instance.
Absolutely. I think the professor makes some excellent points, and I think Kamala Harris is right. Her district was a model. It worked. She had a great experience, and many districts that had large school districts that were also countywide had a good mix of white, black, and other minority students, and so they were able to move kids around and get them integrated. Kansas City has 14 different school districts within the city. It was totally fractured. The suburbs were not interested in helping in this effort. They still aren't. There was competition. Finally, independence took away some of the schools from the Kansas City School District. And by that point, people were so exhausted, they didn't even fight that effort in Kansas City.
Wow.
So I think now, I don't want to say, though, that the Kansas City School District hasn't made some progress. I think the feeling is right now the district is moving towards accreditation. The schools are getting better. It's a much smaller district. But any idea that we would return to massive busing for desegregation, at least in Kansas City, I think is just off the radar.
Because why?
Well, number one,
I mean, the problem of if the schools are as segregated today as they were 20 or 30 years ago, why wouldn't busing be part of the conversation?
Well, I think just because of our past history. Ironically, during the desegregation case, the effort was to lure in white suburban students. So even after the program was, the goal was to improve schools for everybody. But African-American parents felt like really all the effort was geared toward luring in these few numbers of suburban whites. And that has left a sour taste in people's minds. I think just this idea of any kind of a desegregation case based on the past history would be difficult.
Let's go to some phone calls at 816-235-2888. Al from Kansas City, Missouri, you're on the air.
Oh, wow. What a discussion. Anyway, in 1964, I left Sudbury, Goldwater. I was a kid, just first year in college. And innocently, this is before the big social upheaval of the 60s, I asked him what his position was on busing. This is in Henniker, New Hampshire. I believe it was Henniker. And it was a town meeting, and knowing that he was against busing. And he lost it. This is in front of Howard K. Smith, CBS, blah, blah, blah. He lost it. He was waving his arms, yelling at me, telling me I should read the Constitution. I said, I did read the Constitution, and he needs to answer this question. So it went nationally, and anyway, he lost the primary.
Huh.
The situation here, and not because of me, obviously, a number of other things, but the situation here is the same elements that are opposing a comprehensive integration plan, desegregation, if you want to call it, plan in the schools are here today.
Mm-hmm.
We have endemic racism in our culture, and this is a classic example of it. What the people are starting charter schools so that they can have a more diverse element, mix of kids.
Right. So, Al, I appreciate that. Lynn, you want to respond to what Al had to say?
Well, yes, I think he does have a point. Integration worked for many communities, and many communities did buy into it, and it benefited all students. Again, Kansas City had this difficult legal ruling that said the suburbs couldn't be involved. You know, we have tremendous housing segregation in Kansas City. It's incredibly segregated by housing. And trying to rectify that through the schools just proved to be enormously complicated and difficult.
So, Professor, if I understand correctly, your overarching point here is that if a district and parents 30 years ago were committed to busing as a way to desegregate a school system, it could work. If that support wasn't in place, look out. Do I have that right?
I'd certainly agree with the first part of what you said. I think the second part, though, to tie on to your caller's point, is that, you know, and this came up in the debate as well, and in some instances, you may not have the voluntary support, but we need to think about what it is that we're going to want our public schools to be doing as part of their goals. And if that means thinking about things that are not necessarily voluntary, because of the legacy of governmental policies, both in education and outside of education, that have perpetuated the residential segregation that exists today,
right,
then we might need to think about other things. And so that's why there have been some ongoing court challenges challenging the establishment of school district boundary lines, for example. And I agree with Lynn, housing integration has to be part of it. But even that's not going to be enough if we're not also really confronting this legacy of government policies that have perpetuated inequality and segregation.
Professor, just quickly, are you hearing of any cities across the country that are considering a resumption of busing, given the lack of progress on integrating school districts?
Yes, absolutely. One of the largest districts in the country, Wake County, North Carolina, where Raleigh is, they had a pretty widespread, and again, it's a countywide district, so they were busing children across the county to make more integration work. They ended their program about 10 years ago, and they have just adopted a new policy to look at how they're going to institute desegregation again because of the residential patterns. They're going to need to use busing. Charlotte is North Carolina is another example. So I see both individual districts, but I also see some growing awareness that regional efforts are going to have to be part of that. And so whether it's in these states in which there are ongoing challenges to district boundary lines as something perpetuating segregation, or in other places, thinking on a regional basis and involving busing as part of that in a way that is more efficient than, say, what Kansas City was doing, I think is going to be a path forward.
And just, I got 30 seconds left. What can districts do to integrate outside of busing, Professor?
I think you can look at the way in which you're drawing your school attendance zone boundaries to try to create more integration. That's one start.
Okay. We'll leave our conversation there. That was the voice of Dr. Erica Frankenberg, a professor of education at Penn State University. Professor, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Lynn Horsley, a former reporter for The Star. She covered Kansas City schools for any number of years. Lynn, good to have you too.
Thanks so much.
Time for a break. When we come back, we'll talk about what teens can do this summer now that Cinemark theaters on the plaza have closed. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Tomorrow, new research into the health effects of vaping and how kids are using these sometimes hard-to-spot nicotine products in schools. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, with the closing of the Cinemark theaters on the plaza in May, teens have one fewer place to hang out. Former City Councilman John Sharp has said there are no longer many entertainment outlets for youth in the urban core. With the summer of 19 in full swing, it's time to get a read on the impact of Cinemark's closing and what options teens have these days when it comes to having places to go to just hang out. With us, Councilwoman Alicia Candidate is here. She represents the 5th District in Southeast Kansas City. Councilwoman, nice to have you back.
Hi.
Terrion Hudson is a member of Generation Rap. That's a leadership program sponsored by Carter Broadcast Group. Terrion, nice to have you too.
Good morning.
Well, Terrion, Cinemark on the Plaza has closed. That used to be a place where young folks hung out. What's been the impact of that closing?
Well, I feel like the impact of that closing has just simply been one fewer place of, you know, for you to hang out. And it's caused them to, you know, I don't know. Really, I'm really not too sure. I just feel like
it's one less place
for them to hang out. Yeah.
Yeah. Councilwoman Kennedy, what do you think?
I think it removes some of the convenience for some kids that want to go to the movie theater. But kids hanging out in a shopping district is, I mean, that's just as American pie, as they would say.
Mm-hmm.
Kids have been hanging out at the mall. Since there aren't any malls in the area anymore, the plaza became that place. And so while there are other theaters close by, that was probably one of the most conveniently located ones.
So do kids have places to go to hang out, Councilwoman? What do you see as you look across the city? How big of a problem do we have still?
Well, the city's 319 square miles, and so there's plenty of places to hang out. It just depends on which group of kids you're talking about and what they're interested in doing. We have some of the best parks in the country, and I think that for people who are interested in that, they have places to go. When you talk about entertainment such as theaters, I just did a quick search, and I mean, you've got several still in the area. You've got the Alamo Draft House downtown, which easily on the bus transportation. You've got the B&B at Union Station.
Right.
And then you've got Ward Parkway. All of them are all along public transportation. So it's not that they don't have access to a theater. I just think it was one that was very popular and very conveniently located to the core of the city. So there are plenty of options to choose from for other entertainment things to do.
I was going to say, though, we've been talking on this program for years about a lack of places for young people to hang out. Terri-Ann, what do you think? What's you're in that age category. What do you make of it?
Yeah, it's been a lack of places for youth to hang out for a long time. So I created my own place for youth to hang out.
Which is what?
So now I partnered up with the YMCA, and we hold teen nights on Friday nights where we, you know, kids can come. We have like different sections where it's a room where kids can play video games or board games, card games. We got night swimming. It's from 6 p.m. to 10 p.m. Downstairs, basketball, or, you know, they can dance in a room. We have food, and, you know, it lasts for 4 hours, and it's just like a safe place.
Are kids coming?
Definitely.
Yeah, like how many do you get on a Friday night?
Last week, we got maybe about 50 to 60 kids last week.
Yeah.
And with that being like the second one, I feel like it's just going to keep expanding.
So you're saying you were seeing such a problem out there with the lack of places to go for younger people that you created your own thing.
Right.
I bet the mayor's thrilled with that. I bet the councilwoman is thrilled with that because there have been calls for that kind of thing to happen for a long time.
Hopefully they are thrilled.
Was it hard to get it going?
No. Well, hard to find somewhere that, you know, like common ground, somewhere convenient. And, of course, it's at the Linwood Y. How convenient, you know. And it was hard to, you know what I'm saying, get someone to agree to, you know, not give up on the teens. But hard to promote, hard to get kids drawn out to us. No.
Yeah. You know, in announcing this year's curfew season a few weeks ago, Kansas City Police issued a statement that said this: fortunately, there is no shortage of activities for youth in Kansas City, Missouri during the summer months, such as, and the release pointed to these different activities, Club KC events at locations throughout the city, police athletic league nights every Friday and Saturday night at the Pell Center, 1801 White Avenue, public libraries, and summer camps throughout the area. What do you make of that list? Does that solve problems, or is that a realistic look at it?
I really didn't understand the question.
I mean, is that enough of a variety of activities?
No, definitely not.
Yeah, that's the issue, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Alicia Kennedy, what do you make of that list of activities?
I think for those who are looking for a safe environment for their children, for parents who are looking for that, it provides a lot of options and opportunities. The question becomes, is it what the kids want to do?
Right. Mm-hmm.
Because as a parent, if I'm looking for something that's low cost and safe, those are the priorities for most families in this inner city. Those are all good options. Now, will your kid enjoy it if they've been supervised the whole time? Probably not. That's why they like hanging out on the plaza. They liked having unstructured, unsupervised time to hang out with their peers. And that's not really what you get in any of those options. But what we've seen is when you have unstructured, unsupervised time with young people, the risk increases. So I think those are the opportunity costs. I think the kids that understand the value in being in a safe environment definitely, you know, show up and participate, even with what he has at the YMCA.
Yeah.
One of my friends was promoting it. I've shared it with my friends that promote parties on social media to encourage my party-going peers to take their kids.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but again, what's the kids' experience when they get there? That's going to be the difference maker.
I was going to say, Terri-Ann, isn't that the issue that the Councilwoman Kennedy just laid out here, that kids just want to do what kids want to do, unsupervised? Right. They want freedom. They want to do their own thing. They want to act like maybe they're a little older than they really are. And that's what they're really searching for, at least a lot of kids. Is that right?
It could be right, but again, every child is different. Not everyone's the same. So we do have those kids who want to be, you know, a little older than they are. And we also have kids who enjoy childhood.
Mm-hmm. What was it like for kids to be on the plaza? What was your experience going down there on a Friday night or whatever? How did that work for you?
It was something to look forward to. It was fun. Hanging out with the peers, being harassed, not so fun. But
tell me about that. What do you mean being harassed?
Well, my last time on a plaza was, I believe, the end of May. Well, the beginning of May. It was April. The end of April. I had just got back from Atlanta, and I went with some friends down to the plaza. And it was like police officers on horses coming up to us and forcing us to leave. And we weren't disturbing anyone. We weren't even with a crowd. It was like four of us. And we were actually like walking out of the theater. And they're like on horses, leave. And you'll be arrested. And there's some, you know, carrying mace. And I'm just like, what are we doing?
Wow. Councilwoman Kennedy, what do you make of that?
It is disheartening because a show of force is definitely intimidating. And you know, I have a public safety background, being a former prosecutor
right. And
chair of public safety for the city. Our goal is always to make sure we're creating safe spaces where our children are. There have been a number of instances where there have been gun violence. There have been major fights to break out and things of that nature, crowd mobs. The mayor was even, you know, in the midst of some melee at some point.
A few years ago when he first became mayor.
Absolutely.
I think. Yeah.
And so I think the police have taken a number of precautions to try to make sure that while it is a public space, that they do what they can to make sure it's safe for all patrons that are there.
In the course of doing that, have they overreacted in your view?
You know, I've learned not to Monday morning quarterback on things because as a prosecutor, there's so many different sides to the story as it unfolds. So I don't know why they had horses down there, but I'm sure it wasn't because the horses needed to go for a stroll.
Mm-hmm.
So there was some reason why they brought the horses out. And it probably had nothing to do with him or his friends because he had been in Atlanta. So he doesn't know what happened prior to why the horses are there now. He's just like, dang, we can't just hang out and, you know, have a good time. But I think that, I learned at some point there's we have an issue in society with bystander behavior.
Mm-hmm.
When we see our peers acting out of line with our societal norms, we don't want to step in and say, hey, don't mess this up for everybody. We just stand by and idly watch it happen, and then it disrupts a good thing and creates unnecessary enforcement or over-enforcement for others because you don't want it to repeat itself.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that as peers, as young people, and adults as well, because we're seeing violence happening older. Usually people age out of violence at around 25, but we're seeing that necessarily not the case, where people are just not willing to step in and say, hey, that's not okay.
Mm-hmm.
We want to make sure we protect this space and make it enjoyable for everybody. So don't bring that foolishness here. Probably like how you tell people when they come to your events at the YMCA, you started something, you got key partners in place, and you don't want a couple knuckleheads to make it, you know, well, we're not going to do it anymore, where the Y says we're pulling the plug.
Terry, right. How do you handle those situations when they crop up at the YMCA?
What do you mean crop up?
Well, do you have situations, as the councilman just said, where some kids begin to get out of line, and how do you deal with that?
I've never. So even before the Y, I've been throwing events all year since the passing of my sister in February. And never have I ever had to throw a teen out, tell a teen to not come back. Never, ever has security ever it's never been a time where security had to redirect someone, and it's never been a time where I even really had to. Well, at the Y, they wanted the first event to have security, but before me going to the Y and my events, never had security there, and even after that first event, no security.
Yeah.
So it's all about your approach and what it is and what image you portray. So yeah, we got that image where, you know, anytime it's teenagers around, it might be fighting or arguing, but I've never had that in any of my events.
Do you feel police overreacted on the plaza?
Of course.
Yeah, you feel that way. Councilman?
And I like to make a contrast because we have a similar issue with kids hanging out in Zona Rosa, but we're not talking about Zona Rosa today. We're talking about the plaza and the Cinemark. Why is there a difference? Have they ever had to take horses to Zona Rosa? Have we heard about major things happening that way? Not in the same context, not saying that they haven't had issues.
Mm-hmm.
So I do think that there is an opportunity for us to evolve in how we handle youth and public disruptions. I can't say if it was excessive to bring the horses out, but horses in and of themselves are not a bad thing. It really was probably used as crowd control if there was a big group of kids out.
Okay, let me go to some phone calls here. Bill from Kansas City, Kansas. Bill, good morning.
Yeah, I just want to relay, I guess, a bit of my experience. I've worked as part of security down in the Power and Light District for quite some time in the past. And what I observed after the curfew all was put into place was that I would observe 13, 14, 15-year-old little white individuals going to the little rave shows down at what I think they call it now the Arvis Theater. And it was a chock full of drugs and craziness all the time, people passing out and ambulances being called all the time. So I'm thinking that perhaps the uneven enforcement of this curfew rule might be part of the problem, but I also think this pretty firmly, that it was never meant for to be applied to the white children. It was only meant to be applied to black children going down into white commerce space.
Bill, let me just get a comment from Terry on here. Uneven enforcement, have you experienced that yourself?
Yeah, like I told Elizabeth before, I actually had an experience. Like, my mom has a I know some white kids from my mom. Her friend's white. And so I was on the plaza with some of her kids before. And I wasn't bothered. I was like the only black kid with them. We weren't bothered.
Because you were with white kids, you're saying.
Yeah, we were just, you know, we were chilling. We weren't bothered. But like I said, when I came back from Atlanta and I was with my group of African-American friends, they pulling out mace and coming up to us with horse, forcing us to leave without, you know, reason.
I'm like, here in Kansas City, you're saying.
Right. And I'm like, well, why do I have to leave? They're like, you know, basically not to ask them questions. If I, you know, if I'm not agreeing with them and leaving, that they will arrest me.
I was going to say that curfew in Kansas City, the citywide curfew is 10 o'clock for those 15 and younger, 11 o'clock for those 16 and 17. Is the curfew reasonable, Councilman Kennedy?
I think it was a reasonable approach based on the issues we were dealing with.
Is it effective?
I think it's really helped us address some issues where we had, you know, minors out after hours to create accountability, because prior to us and putting it in place, there really wasn't much you can do. So if you got, you know, a bunch of 15-year-olds hanging out in an entertainment district, whether they're doing something they shouldn't be doing or not, but if there's alcohol involved, things like that, it's kind of like, okay, you're unsupervised. Let's create some accountability. So it's allowed us to be able to do that. PD did bring in the social workers to deal with the youth issue as an approach so that it would not be over enforcement. So you don't have officers in uniform, engaging with kids, essentially. And I think that was a very effective approach and helped reduce some of the challenges that we were dealing with at the time.
Pastor Blunt's on the air here from Kansas City, Missouri. Pastor, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks, Steve, for taking my call. I just wanted to suggest that back in the early days, you know, I'm a Kansas City resident, lifelong resident, but I haven't been here all of my life. But one of the things we had back in the day, we had the theater right there on 31st and Prospect. Mm-hmm. And why can't we can't have a theater right here in our neighborhood so that when our kids come together, you know, their behavior doesn't look absurd to us. We could just have a theater right here, maybe in the 18th and Vine District, and build that area up and make it an attractive area for our teens to come to. Therefore, we don't have that cultural or class collision that occurs. From
Pastor, I got to get a response from Councilman Kennedy. Why can't we get a movie complex over at 31st and Prospect or 18th and Vine, Councilman?
We can if we have a developer that's willing to come forward and make that investment.
Why don't we?
Well, that's we're on public air, and I think there's a lot of people who operate in that space now. We would welcome that. We did have one individual approach us. Matter of fact, the guy who operates the B&B theaters and expressed an interest at a site that the city had control over as a possibility. And so, you know, we'll see what happens with that, where it would evolve. But again, it's up to the investors to decide where they want to make the investment.
So we still have work to do on this issue of where teens can hang.
Well, I think that there are a number of places where teens can hang. I think we need to address the issue of getting them to be willing to go to those places, those designated places.
That's Councilwoman Alicia Kennedy from the 5th District of Kansas City. Terrion Hudson, a member of Generation Rap. Thank you both for coming in and talking to us. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Coming up, Brian McTavish and some fun stuff to do this weekend.
magic woman. I've got a black magic woman. Got me so blind I can't see.
You know, I love this album when it came out back in the day, and it still sounds good. Brian McTavish is here to talk about his weekend to-do list, fun stuff to do. Welcome back.
Back in the day, you remember this when it came out brand new? Yes, I do. You were just a kiddo.
Spent a lot of time looking at the album cover, but we'll talk about that some other time.
That was a few years later, yeah.
Okay,
it's Santana, Carlos Santana.
And his new album is supposed to be terrific.
Yeah, Africa Speaks. I couldn't resist playing an oldie.
Yeah.
In advance of Santana's 7 o'clock show tonight.
Tonight.
With the Doobie Brothers at Sprint Center.
Wow.
But yes, indeed, his new album, Africa Speaks, it is inspired by some of the tunes and sounds and interesting rhythms of Africa.
Can you still get a seat?
You bet you can.
Yeah.
It's called the secondary market, if need be. You want to sit close? Bring your money.
Yeah.
You want to sit far away? Bring less money. But you bet you can, sure. He's still promoting peace, love, and understanding. 50 years, count them, after Woodstock.
Wow. Yeah.
Rock and Roll Hall of Fame guitarist, Latin, rock, jazz artist. But here's the deal. He continues to be a great proponent of global justice and brotherhood. Half a century later, after Peace, Love, and Understanding, it's his living legacy. He's reaching out. He's helping. The groups he officially supports include, the Museum of Tolerance, Save the Children, Doctors Without Borders, Rainforest Action Network, Greenpeace. You get the idea. Plus the Doobies. Let's not forget the Doobies, including a few original members tonight at Sprint Center.
That's Santana.
Waves of fear attack in the night. Waves of repulsion, sickening sights. My heart's nearly bursting, my chest choking tight. Waves of fear.
What do we have here?
Attention, fear mongers. It's Crypticon. That is Lou Reed, who knew about fear for sure. Anyway, it's an appropriate ditty to accompany our ensuing conversation, brief as it may be, regarding Crypticon, Kansas City. Hmm. It's the annual sci-fi and horror fan convention, so large, so looming, so distressing, it cannot be contained to Kansas City. That's why you'll have to go to St. Joseph Civic Arena in St. Joseph, but it's well worth it. Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, pop culture, sci-fi, horror, out the you-know. What? Just a few quick hits on the guest list, okay? Because if you like the weird, if you like the crazy, if you like the petrifyingly scary, this is your element, okay? Joe Bob Briggs, the veteran science fiction, horror, and schlock movie expert, will be there. Tom Savini, the horror movie prosthetic makeup artist. Maybe you saw things dripping off of the faces he created for Dawn of the Dead and Day of the Dead and Creepshow. But let's not forget Dee Wallace.
Mm.
Not only was she the mom in E.T., but she appeared in The Howling and Cujo. And if that's not enough for you, and how could it be? A shock fest, film fest, and a superhero, a horror, and a separate kitty cosplay contest all weekend at Crypticon KC in, strangely enough, St. Joe.
So, why don't you?
Let's talk about the truth. Tell me the truth.
Well, what is the truth?
There's a question.
There's a question. You've been trying to get at it for how many years
now? That could be a whole nother talk show.
Well, let's stick to the truth if we can. This is a different event. It's called Truth in Comedy. And in a nutshell, it's spontaneous stand-up comedy and an art show inspired by people sharing their stories of personal truth.
Mm-hmm.
So, exactly. You're not too sure. It's all going to be true and funny, I hope. 7 o'clock Saturday, where else but the Bunker Center for the Performing Arts on 19th Street.
I've not heard of the Bunker Center for the Performing Arts.
You should go there. It's at 1914 East 19th Street. Bunker Center for the Performing Arts, Truth and Comedy. Three different comics will perform a set inspired by the three different stories they hear explained to audience members. And then at the end, there's an artist who will present a finished triptych inspired by the stories. And real quickly, I want to tack on here. Here's another event if you really want some twisted truth. This is cool. You can join, and why not, a book discussion of Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, The Savage Journey to the Heart of the American Dream. It was written by scathing gonzo journalist Hunter S. Thompson and liberally illustrated by artist Ralph Steadman. You can take part in the book group at 2 o'clock Sunday afternoon at the Downtown Central Library. Mm. It's in conjunction with the library's current art exhibit, Ralph Steadman, A Retrospective, which includes a whole bunch of wild illustrations from Fear and Loathing. The book is super short. If you've never read it, read it tonight and go to the... Go.
Okay.
Go.
What do we have here?
Okay, the classic rock will be coming out of Santana tonight at Sprint Center, as previously mentioned. But hey, how about some more classic rock, both real and imagined? First, the real classic rock. Mike Finnegan, right? Mike Finnegan, he plays Doors Open at 6. He'll go on later Saturday in Lawrence at Abe and Jake's. Mike Finnegan is the guy from this area. He went to KU on a basketball scholarship. He toured and did session work for Jimi Hendrix, like Electric Ladyland, and Joe Cocker and Etta James and Crosby, Stills and Nash and Buddy Guy and Bonnie Raitt. So he's a real deal rock history, living rock history guy. That's Saturday at Abe and Jake's in Lawrence. Dan, you want some imaginary rock? Okay, hey, here you go. They'll be very popular, and I think both, well, this is free. Liverpool, of course, the Beatles tribute act with Brody Buster's one-man band, 6 o'clock Friday. Go to Frontier Park in Olathe, and you will be entertained. And finally, Almost Kiss, the Kiss tribute band, and KCDC, the, of course, AC/DC tribute band, join forces for a show Saturday at 8:30 at the Star Pavilion at Ameristar Casino.
And finally today... Man, this is something. I had a neighbor who played in this band, I think.
Oh, you're talking about
the Glenn Miller band.
Oh, the real Glenn Miller band?
The real Glenn Miller band. Just
Is he still with us?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
No. Okay, I got you. Okay, so here's the deal. Hey, the world can be a hard place. The truth can be hard to face. Kick back, enjoy yourself, and maybe get a little nostalgic for a time you maybe never knew yourself, but can pretend to have known once upon a time. It's Dance at the Depot. It's USO-style swing dancing. Music provided by the Moonlight Serenade Orchestra, making like Glenn Miller here. Plus, get this, a free dance lesson. So if you show up at 7:30 Friday at the Union Station Grand Ballroom, you get a free dance lesson. You learn how to swing. Be careful, you can hurt yourself. And then and then the actual dancing starts at 8. Hey, if
you're not... That's a lot of athleticism involved in this.
Look, well, kind of like this segment, right?
Yes.
So hey, if you're not a hep cat yet, you might be kind of after this. Just consider it one step at a time on the stairway to swing dance heaven.
Ooh. What a way to go out. That's Brian McTavish and your weekend to-do list. Thank you, buddy.
Thanks.
Tomorrow on the show, KU researchers recently found that vaping, get this, can cause some of the same diseases as normal cigarettes. We'll learn what they found. Our show is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Elizabeth Ruiz, and Emily Aiken. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.